Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
The following is a special presentation of Alpha Media. Welcome to Beyond the Headlines, in-depth interviews on topics of concern here in Portland and the Northwest. Now, here's your host, Brett Recap.
Thank you very much. Welcome in. You have the 511th edition of Beyond the Headlines, a behind-the-scenes look at some of the stories making news here in the Pacific Northwest and beyond as we move through this month of April 2024 on all seven of our Alpha Media Portland radio stations, including FM News 101. Okay, the state of Oregon has some new rules this year that OSHA is enforcing. This is very important stuff when it comes to businesses keeping employees safe on the job site and for when owners and managers are not doing the right things. This is the exact type of thing that our friends at SAFE are always watching closely. To get an update on new laws on the books, how they work, and how OSHA is involved, we checked in with Aubrey Sakaguchi, Safety Services Supervisor for SAFE. Aubrey starts off our conversation by giving us a little backstory of the bill in the Oregon State House that got passed and signed into law.
Last May, the Oregon legislator passed Senate Bill 592. And what that Senate bill did was it increased the fines that employers have to pay if they are found to be in violation of the occupational health and safety codes here in Oregon. That is new. And it also brought in a workplace inspection that didn't previously exist that comes along with an investigation by DCBS, which is the Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Okay, so if you get caught, you're a business in violation. Does this mean, well, A, you could pay more, that the fines would be worse, that the penalties could be worse, and that you might need to be a little bit more on your toes?
Absolutely. And at SAFE, we really want to be proactive. We believe in addressing safety and health issues before they become an incident, before there's an injury, and absolutely before you get violations from Oregon OSHA inspections.
Now, you're in the business of safety over 100 years in the state of Oregon. From your perspective, was this stuff needed? Are you hearing from businesses and the government? Because you're kind of a liaison, if you will. Was this a need, or were the laws old?
That's a great question, Brett. The laws had not been updated in quite some time. Just a few months ago, we had a training hosted with Brian Snapp, who is the statewide safety enforcement manager at Oregon OSHA. He did a nice job explaining the history of the bill, the data that went into this bill and its implementation that started in 2023. That training is live for anybody that wants to go watch it. You can find that at saif.com/training and then scroll down to where there's a header that says OSHA. Brian really delves into that.
They do provide an important service. They are in some ways the police, right? When it comes to business, you're like, no, OSHA. You don't want, quote, OSHA fines or them coming down on you. But maybe you could just describe how they operate and what they do for safety.
They are somewhat like the police in that regard, as you said, Brett. They are enforcing the laws and the codes that are out there. So if you are a business owner and operator and you want to get ahead of those, SAFE is a great partner. We have news and tips that come out in an email format, and those highlight a different OSHA violation each month. Along with that, there are tips and resources to help keep your safety and health program on track. There's resources for your safety and health committees. There's videos, posters, talking points to help keep things fresh and exciting while being very proactive and getting ahead of violations that might be found should you have an inspection.
Got it. So now that things have changed, I don't know if we're getting too far into the weeds for specifics, but do you have any examples of some of the most common things that might be found on job sites or in businesses that are no-nos?
We do. SAFE did a deeper dive into the frequently cited violations from 2023. The most common one is not having a written hazard communication program. That's the directive that says if you've got a bottle of liquid, we need to know what's inside that liquid and how can it be dangerous. And then we also looked at what's the most expensive. Not surprising, the most expensive is a very serious hazard, and it was the lack of fall protection for employees working at heights.
How many times have you heard that, Aubrey? It's just slips, trips, and falls. A lot of times they're like, oh, sure, I won't be silly in that regard. But here they are popping up as the most common and the most expensive, right?
Absolutely.
And when you say communication, because you mentioned that was one of the most important things, how does that look? Basically, OSHA comes in and says, well, number one, if you can't communicate, then people don't know what the rules are and how can they adhere to them, if you will. So is it physically just something that's on the wall? They take a look and it's not there?
I love this question, Brett. Safety nerds like myself geek out about this is fun stuff. So many ways to communicate this. Yes, we do have to have a written program about how we mesh that, but that communication also comes along with training. So your employees understand what they need to know. The other component of that is written or illustrated labels on those hazards. The Global Harmonization System is over a decade old now, and it gave us pictograms. So, in workplaces where we have multiple languages and various education levels, those pictograms are communicating what is dangerous about a hazard and a chemical.
Okay, a pictogram is an image that people can understand. It doesn't use words, is that correct? And it is available for anyone of any language.
Spot on. And there's so many resources on this, Brett, at SAIF.com. That's SAIF.com.
Okay, and then for timing here, Aubrey, for SB 592, is it already kicked in or is it in full force? Where are we as far as the implementation?
We are in full force with Senate Bill 592. It was passed in 2023, but Oregon OSHA has guidelines about how they are able to make those rules. So that took us into this year. And yes, we are seeing those higher penalties and the repeat penalties. It is rolling. It's a great opportunity to get ahead before you have an inspection in your workplace.
Got that right. And that's one reason you guys are there. Can it set a business back? Maybe hard to put a dollar figure on, but when it comes to violations or just not having good communication, from your perspective, what does it do to a business?
You ask, can it set a business back? And Brett, that is exactly what we're seeing with some of the violations we're getting notification of. In fact, there was just one that we saw last week, $40,000. And it wouldn't have been so high had the employer fixed the problem the first time they were notified it was a violation. These are steep fines, and businesses have so many other better places to spend money if they get ahead of this. So we do want to partner. We want to help prevent these. These fines are paired much more consistent with federal fines that had been higher along the way. So they're nothing to joke about.
Okay, well said. I think we're good to go. I'm super glad that you were able to lay out some of the rules because, again, this comes right off the bottom line if something goes wrong. And plus, it's bad for morale and it's also bad for production, really.
It is. Safety is related to the success of a business. So utilize our resources. Give us a call. We'd love to help keep an Oregon business safe and healthy.
And there is Aubrey Sakaguchi with SAFE. Great info on these new stiffened laws affecting how OSHA deals with safety violations and inspections at workplaces in Oregon. Again, a lot of great info on this and other things always available at SAFE.com. That's SAIF, SAFE.com. The Black and Loud Music Festival is in Portland this weekend. KXL's James Shippey sat down with one of the founders to talk about the past, present, and future of black rock and roll. It's a very cool story that we're happy to bring you to give you an idea of what's happening. Before I play James's interview with Cameron Lavie Jones of King Youngblood, I figured I'd play James's news story first to give you an idea of what's going on.
After two successful years in Washington, Cameron Lavie Jones of King Youngblood along with Anthony Briscoe of Down North, are bringing the festival to the Rose City. And along with hoping to inspire the next generation of minority rock musicians, they're hoping fans from all over the city will come to have a great time.
We're hosting it at the Bossa Nova Ballroom on April 6th, and we're planting in three different stages at the venue with music genres across the board of alternative black folks, bands, and I just feel very grateful that there is something for everybody there. There is something for the folks aligned with the purpose of what Black and Loud Fest is setting out to accomplish, and there's something there just for people that love good music.
For more info on the festival, including a link to buy tickets, head to KXL.com. James Shippen, FM News 101.
I like that. Thank you, James. And with that, here is KXL's James Shippey speaking with Cameron Lavie-Jones of King Youngblood.
For like folks that may not know, can you just tell us a little bit about the Black and Loud Music Festival coming to Portland?
Yeah, absolutely. So Black and Loud Music Fest is a celebration of Black-fronted bands that everybody, all walks of life, are invited to. Me and the other co-founder of the music festival, Anthony Briscoe of Down North, we first came up with the idea back in 2018. We were both playing a music festival and noticed we were the only black bands on the bill of the festival. And so we were backstage talking about how, especially in the Pacific Northwest, representation with black bands or just alternative black artists is sometimes it can kind of feel like we're in an ocean, for lack of a better word. So we came together and after COVID, put together the very first Black and Loud Music Festival in 2022 through the grace of community and, you know, other people on our team, namely King Youngblood's manager, Laura Lavie. We were able to partner with Jack Daniels, who became our title sponsor for the festival, and through the very first Black and Loud Festival back here in Seattle. And from there, it's just been building and growing to the point where now we actually have the opportunity to bring it to Portland, kicking it across state lines for the very first time. And we felt like Portland was the perfect next place to take it, especially in line with the message of trying to put on and share other folks in that celebration of Black-fronted bands, especially knowing that in the Pacific Northwest, kind of overall, Black artists face very similar challenges when it comes to finding community, feeling like there are folks in the music world, just period, that are actually there to listen, to pay attention, and give space to the ways that these folks are continuing the legacy of musical contributions that Black artists have made historically to the larger realm of just, you know, American culture in and of itself, but especially American popular culture and musical culture. Our whole MO is we want to make sure that people are given their flowers now rather than years and years and years after the fact for their contributions or the ways that they have participated in music scenes that can feel kind of challenging to feel isolated in representation-wise.
How has people's response been? Because like I said, when they normally see rock music, like I said, they don't normally see black folks.
I think a lot of it is seeing is believing. When it comes to representation, especially in genres that black folks invented and created in the first place, I mean, rock and roll music was not invented by Elvis. It was invented by Sister Rosetta Tharpe. Grunge music was not founded by, you know, Nirvana and Soundgarden. It was founded by Tina Bell. These folks that throughout history were not given the due credit for the ways that they impacted and really pioneered so many things that after enough time that other folks really adopted and ran with, and music that I really love as well too, but it's still from a historical context. There's been a pattern, unfortunately repeating of, black folks contributing and being kind of left out of that larger pantheon of the larger culture of those genres, simply because of the color of their skin. And for us, at least speaking personally with King Youngblood, truthfully, it's very in line with why I got into music in the first place. I got into music and especially into alternative rock and heavier music, you know, back in like middle school. My favorite band was System of a Down. And it was music that was very specifically politically pointed as well as, you know, very heavy and abrasive. And it really showcased to me that the intersections of art and activism are not only possible, but very oftentimes it really makes the music more important when you know that there's purpose behind it. And extending that idea and that philosophy even bigger to Black and Lounge Festival has been massively impactful. You know, the second Black and Lounge Festival we did back in Seattle, you know, it was after we kind of had an opportunity to prove to our community that, like, hey, like, we're here and you are welcome here. And I know there's a video clip of it somewhere where after King Youngblood set, you know, we're doing like the finale of our last song. And I just stared out to this room that was just completely packed, full of Black and brown faces, full of white faces, full of everybody a part of this community, and seeing and feeling that actual acceptance. And I know that if I felt that way after, you know, so long of pushing in this band and doing the hard work that is truthfully sometimes feels like going against the grain, sharing that bond and that feeling of seenness is something that I think really aligns people. It aligns people in a way that allows them to recognize where we are more similar rather than different, and truthfully bond over a joy of just good music. I would be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, every time we do the festival, I think there's different misconceptions about what Black and Lounge Festival is. You know, the first time that we did it, we got a lot of pushback, truthfully, of folks thinking that it was like toting claims like reverse racism, or like it's an exclusionary event, when since day one, we've always said it's a celebration that everyone is invited to. And kind of dealing with that misconception that holding space for an underrepresented group is somehow excluding from other people. You know, that was a challenge in the first year, and something that is always kind of critical for us to explain as we go forward for folks that just don't quite understand why it is so crucial to have specifically all Black friends bands on a music festival, which is very not done in the Pacific Northwest to any capacity. But last year, we had a really interesting kind of different misconception, kind of on the opposite end, of folks that meant well and meant very, you know, to be very respectful, but thought that them attending the event and not being Black was them taking up space that, you know, them taking up space at an event where they're not supposed to be there or something like that. And that isn't the right way to go about it either. Very, very obviously, you know, their heart was in the right place of trying to be respectful in all of that aspect. But also the ways that we uplift and support underrepresented communities is not by leaving them alone or ignoring them. It's about being an active participant in the ways that they operate, the ways that they go about their career. And truthfully, it's as simple as, if this is a celebration that everyone is invited to, guess what? You're everyone. Come and celebrate with us. And so, yeah, it's been a journey of trying to operate in purpose, but also educating, truthfully. And I'm really grateful for that, because I feel, at least personally, it's very healing for myself too. It's very healing to participate in these different communities and dismantle those kind of preconceived notions about what quote unquote Black music is, what quote unquote white music is, especially in, you know, the rock world. And especially it feels very gratifying to help kind of undo some of the challenges that I've faced in my own career. And I know that other Black bands, Black friended bands, have faced in their progression of their careers in the Pacific Northwest. It feels good to be able to do my part in dismantling those preconceived notions in order to help try to make it easier for the next band. You know, like, I know I'm kind of running on and on, but we recently just played a show, King Youngblood, we just played a show in Everett. And Everett, Washington, has a very low Black population in the town. But, you know, the last time we played Everett was a couple of years before that, at this music festival called Fisherman's Village. And I remember I got off stage and there was this 14-year-old Black kid that came up to me and he said, hey, like, thank you. I didn't know we could do that. And 2 years later, after that show, that kid came to our show at a venue in Everett. And he told me that he you know, I immediately recognized him. He got straight to the front, and I had a chance to see him after the show, and he told me that he had started a band since then. And I almost damn near cried because he asked if he could cover one of King Youngblood's songs in his band. But it was just, those are the things, those are the products of what happens when we are able to align our purpose with what we're trying to do creatively. And also, damn it, we're having fun doing it too. These shows are exciting. And regardless of the purpose or the activism behind it or anything like that, these shows and this music festival is a good time. We're hosting it at the Bossa Nova Ballroom on April 6th. And we're planting in three different stages at the venue with music genres across the board of alternative Black folks and bands. And I feel very grateful that there is something for everybody there. There is something for the folks aligned with the purpose of what Black and Loud Fest is setting out to accomplish. And there's something there just for people that love good music.
You know what? That's great. Because at the end of the day, you know, you do this kind of art. If you can be an inspiration to like the next generation coming up, that's what it's all about.
I could even get even deeper on that, truthfully, because Angelo Moore, the head honcho for this year's Black and Loud Music Festival at Bossa Nova, Angelo Moore of Fishbone and his band Dr. Mad Vibe and the Missing Links are closing out the festival. And King Youngblood had a chance to do a couple of tours with Fishbone, who in a very similar way were pioneers, truthfully, of alternative Black music. And it was definitely a bit of meeting your heroes in that aspect, and a reminder and inspiration of what happens when you dedicate yourself to what you're trying to accomplish. You know, I'm really grateful for, you know, the different conversations I've had with Norwood from Fishbone, the different conversations I've had with Chris Dowd from Fishbone, and the different conversations I've had with Angelo, and especially getting an opportunity to put folks on to, truthfully, one of the members of a band that did so much to open up the gates for me to be able to do my own thing in King Youngblood. It feels very full circle in that way. And I'm really grateful for the opportunity to, for lack of a better word, share the gospel.
Awesome. Great interview. Great story there. Thanks again, KXL's James Shippey, for bringing us that. That's Cameron Lavie-Jones of King Youngblood, the Black and Loud Music Festival in Portland this weekend. You're listening to the 511th edition of Beyond the Headlines. I'm your host, Brett Recamp. So Portland is a sanctuary city, and Oregon is a sanctuary state. For 80 asylum seekers petitioning the federal government to stay in the U.S., time is running out. Local nonprofit Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice has been paying for them to stay in a hotel, but that money is dried up. The city of Portland and Multnomah County stepping in temporarily. Reporter Blair Best from our news partner KGW reports the families, which include some 30 children, may soon be on the streets.
On Wednesday, we heard from Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson for the first time about this.
So what was the thought process around handing tents to these 80 people?
You know, I don't know exactly what the thought process was around the tents. I think that there was outreach that had happened last week. And I think in the best possible, you know, with the best possible meaning, our staff were like, this is the assistance that I can provide you right now. You know, so I applaud that kind of problem solving, but that is in no way like a long-term plan. I'm directing Multnomah County to look for resources to help pay for one more month to help these families.
In 2022, the Oregon Department of Human Services spent $29 million on a welcome center for asylum seekers. That program ended this past December, and it's not clear what the plan was for these families once it closed. The legislature just approved another $2 million for community groups to help incoming families.
But that isn't enough. And so I really, you know, I'm looking for having a conversation, a partnership about what are we going to do to address the issue of folks who are going to continue to come into our state.
I was shocked. I first heard about it when you reported on it.
Multnomah County Commissioner Sharon Myron also speaking out against giving the asylum seekers tents instead of housing.
Putting people who have been traumatized, children who have been traumatized, onto the street and offering them tents is it's appalling.
Do you think you and the rest of the commissioners will come up with a solution come Friday?
We better.
Tomorrow, there is a Multnomah County board meeting about this where commissioners are hoping to come up with some form of a plan so these families don't end up on the streets come this weekend.
KGW's Blair Best reporting, Multnomah County's official X account tweeted that they do plan to pay for housing through the end of April. We wrap up this week with some politics with our political analyst, Dr. Jim Moore from Pacific University. Dr. Jim talks with me about several national presidential topics, starting with how President Biden and former President Trump are handling two major national issues, immigration and abortion.
Yeah, in the past, especially 2 years, we have seen abortion actually be featured in elections, and it has actually caused surprising results. So the Kansas vote, where they had a statewide measure, should abortion be protected? And very strongly, red state Kansas said, yes, we should protect abortion. So abortion has shown that it does move the needle, but it's not clear in a presidential election where there's only 5 or 6 battleground states if it moves the needle in the right places. That's the key, big thing. So all the stuff about Florida and the Florida Supreme Court saying that abortion, there can be an abortion issue on the ballot in November. Democrats are saying, yay, does it move the needle enough to give the Democrats even a prayer in Florida? Completely unknown, and I would doubt it because Florida is pretty strongly Republican. Immigration, there is no evidence that it does move the needle when immigration gets to a ballot or is part of a candidacy. But the Republicans and Trump have said, we want that to be the central part of our campaign. Here's the big issue with immigration. Immigration is something that everybody has an opinion about right now, very much like abortion. But unless you live in an area where immigration is really front and center, a border area, a place where jobs have been replaced by people who are from out of the country, unless you live in those places, immigration is like your number 5, 6, 7 issue. It does not drive you to cast your ballot. Both parties are playing with these big issues, saying this is going to be the killer issue, and the evidence is weak on abortion and extremely weak on immigration that it actually does that.
Okay, Dr. Jim Moore, there is immigration and abortion, a couple of national issues. What about the economy? Where are we at now? Is it too early? We're seeing some pretty decent reports, but yet people, a lot of times, they gauge the economy on how they're doing with their personal finances, and things are still expensive. Gas prices fluctuate, you know, jobs, blah, blah, blah. As we move into the summer, you know, at the end of the day, it's the economy stupid. Is that going to be the biggest issue?
If we look at history, yes, it will be, but so far it has not been. And so that's a confusing thing about this issue, about this election. And it may be because people are just focusing on the personality of Trump and the personality of Biden. And so the economy, in effect, is important, but it's down farther on the list. Here's what we know about the economy and voters. It turns out it's not how the economy is doing when you cast your ballot. People make up their minds about how the economy is doing the summer before the election. So coming up here, June, July, August, people will look out there and say, how am I doing? Are prices still too high? Do I pay attention to that? Have I gotten a raise at work? Do I feel more secure? Is my industry secure, or is AI coming for it? You know, whatever it is, that's when people will make up their minds. And so the economy is something that the Republicans and Democrats both want to take advantage of for their own political gains. But the voters will take a few months from now to really settle in and make those choices.
Would an apathetic turnout, a small turnout, and again, we are always talking about the battleground states, at least for 2024, we are certainly, and it's about 7 states-ish, right, that will, in fact, decide the election based on the Electoral College. But does a light turnout benefit either candidate?
It depends totally on the state. So in the battleground states, if you look at it just on the back of an envelope right now, I think it would favor the Republican candidate. I think it would favor Trump in about 4 out of those 6 or 7. Just historical trends and things like that. Here's another thing that we know. When people go to the ballot, if they're there for the presidential race only, Republicans tend to fill out more of the ballot. They then say, oh, I voted for the Republican candidate for president. I'm going to vote for the Republican candidate for Senate, for Congress, for my state legislature. Democrats tend to give up after 1 or 2 votes at the top, and they just don't vote lower down on the ballot. So there could be really interesting, if there's a low turnout election, really interesting reverberations in those battleground states when you look at state legislatures and county commissions and all the rest.
Love hearing from Dr. Jim. Fascinating stuff indeed. Great perspective from our KXL political analyst, Dr. Jim Moore from Pacific University. You have been listening to Beyond the Headlines, a behind-the-scenes look at some of this week's stories. You can follow me on X, formerly Twitter, at Brett Recamp. If you miss a podcast, you can catch it anywhere you get your podcasts. It's up now. Just look for Beyond the Headlines, KXL. We now have 511 shows to choose from. For Alpha Media USA in downtown Portland, I'm Brett Recamp on FM News 101.
This has been Beyond the Headlines. In-depth interviews on topics of concern here in Portland and the Northwest. This has been a special presentation of Alpha Media.